Welcome to Book Notes, Ohio Channel's conversation show featuring Ohio authors and books about Ohio. Amy Butcher's award-winning essays have appeared in the New York Times, the Iowa Review, the American Scholar, and Salon. Her first book, Visiting Hours, chronicles her relationship with a college friend who commits a brutal murder. Amy is currently an assistant professor of English at Ohio Wesleyan University. And thank you, Amy Butcher, for joining us today.
And thank you so much, Dan, for having me.
So essays, why were you attracted to that and not fiction or another genre?
That's a great question. I mean, in a lot of ways, I think essays were the natural sort of genre for me to be working in, the natural form, but they were really the last form that I came to. I started as a teenager, I think like many teenagers, I was writing predominantly fiction novels, really throwing my weight behind that because that's what I was reading. Mm-hmm. When I got to college, I became really interested in poetry and in fact became sort of an archetypal poet. I became vegetarian and went to political protests. It was all very, I think, college. And it wasn't until my senior year that I started exploring. I took a personal essay class and I read during that class David Foster Wallace's edited Best American Essays Anthology, which was the 2007 edition. And I remember reading those essays, in particular Joanne Beard's Warner, and it's a narrative essay. And I had no idea that the essay could take that form, that it could in many ways sort of mimic fiction, but with the added component of this was real, this happened, this is a human story. And I felt really connected to that essay in particular. And so when I decided to pursue an MFA in writing, I applied in all the genres, but I think I was most interested in this new genre that I felt in many ways I'd sort of just discovered. And as it happened, that was the program that I got into at the University of Iowa in nonfiction with a stipend and a teaching ride, which of course makes a idea of spending 3 years on your creative writing a little more financially feasible. But also I think it was really exciting to me because I felt like there was so much potential in the genre and so many things I was interested in reading. At the time, I was reading a lot of David Sedaris. I think he's in many ways the gateway drug of nonfiction writers. And I really loved writing short comedic pieces, which is originally what I intended to do when I arrived at the University of Iowa.
So how do you know when an event in your life is going to be an essay? Are you ever in the experience of being like, ooh, this is going to make a good story? Or is this usually happen reflectively?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, there are certainly experiences that I've had that I think this would translate very well into a piece of writing. I recently, for example, had the opportunity, I've been kind of obsessed with Alaska lately and the people that I meet in Alaska. And in particular, I met a man who is in the process of restoring a World War II era tugboat that he lives on in an Alaskan harbor year round with a new baby and a new wife. And so recently he invited me up to kind of spend time with him and then live on the boat myself for a month while he was traveling. So that's the kind of experience that inherently I think lends itself to really interesting material. I'm sort of fascinated by sort of the stories that don't get told, either because they sort of butt up against sort of a universally accepted or sort of comfortable truth, or because these people are busy or they're doing other things. They're not interested in writing. I see, you know, for as much as I often write about my own experiences and sort of mind my own life, I'm increasingly interested in the stories that aren't being told because those people are doing other things. They're living their life in a way that doesn't necessarily invoke writing itself directly.
So you're kind of looking at the periphery.
I am, absolutely, yeah. And I think, you know, in general, my objective is never to think, oh, could I write about this? I think it's to live life very fully. But of course, I mean, there are opportunities that sort of come up or experiences that happen that I think this is something that, I mean, in a lot of ways, an essay is a grappling. That's kind of how I see it. A mind on a page is what one of my mentors, John DeGatta, talks about. And so I think when I'm in a moment where it does seem like, you know, I'm spending a lot of kind of emotional or mental energy on it, it seems like there's something there that I could use for my writing.
I think it was Henry Miller that said, to live broadly and write boldly, or so I may have lived boldly and write broadly. I can't. Something
absolutely. Like, yeah. I mean, very much that. Very much that. And I think especially, you know, this interest in Alaska, I think it just, everyone I meet up there has a story to tell. And a lot of people are from other places, which I find really fascinating. Certainly, I think Alaska is the last frontier in a lot of ways, this wild place.
How important do you think that having a good school sets you up then as a professional writer?
It's a great question, and actually one that I struggle with now that I am teaching students and young writers. Because the whole idea, I think, is that an MFA, more than anything what I tell my students, is it's an investment in yourself and in your writing. It's, you know, 2 or 3 years. Ideally, if you're lucky, you can get some funding out of that, at least to make ends meet, and you can essentially read and write and teach, generally. But you get to be involved in your craft in a way that I think the real world in a, you know, 40-hour-a-week job makes it very difficult to do. So it's useful in that sense. I mean, when I think about my education, the classes were incredibly important. The training was incredibly important. But more than anything, I think it was being surrounded by people who were equally passionate and sort of obsessed in some ways with writing really beautiful sentences and writing really beautiful pieces. So it is helpful in that sense, certainly. But in terms of the degree, I mean, an MFA is a really cumbersome degree in some ways. It doesn't necessarily translate into a job. For some of us, it's resulted in teaching. Others are doing markedly different things. One of my colleagues is actually, she mushes dogs in Wisconsin now as part of a sled dog team. And I think those are, I think we all kind of gravitate towards whatever interest we have. I love working with students and teenagers in particular, so that lends itself nicely to what I do. But essentially, I think it's really just an investment in your writing. It's time to think and read and meet people who have ideas that will no doubt sort of challenge and inspire you as well.
If you're in Alaska, you could do the Iditarod.
I absolutely could. And in fact, there was a butcher, a famous female butcher who was the Iditarod, I think, champion, or at least did very, very well. And so when I travel up there, I'm always asked if I'm related. And I wish I could say that I was, but I'm not, unfortunately.
Who do you rely on to, while you're investing in a piece, while you're writing a piece, who do you rely on to give you good comments?
That's a great question. I can't say that I really have a readership. I mean, and in a lot of ways, I think that's where the MFA is helpful, is that you have deadlines you have to meet. You have an essay due, let's say, every month or so. And then you have, you know, anywhere from 12 to 20 or so individuals reading your work and offering that feedback. I think the thing that I miss most about being out of the program is that there isn't that. And certainly I have readers. I've actually recently started here in Columbus a little writing group. There's only 4 of us, and we meet once a month. But they're women from sort of all different areas, all of us interested in writing. All of us have projects, I think, in mind that we're sort of testing out. But in some way, I mean, I've kind of become, I think for the most part, I write for myself as much as I can. And then at that point, if there's someone who can look over the work, that's really helpful and integral. But it's not always something that I can rely on, which again is that benefit of that community.
You know, it's interesting. I was just reading about Chuck Palahniuk.
He was my favorite writer all through high school.
And he's got this big writer group. Mm-hmm. Well, not a big, but it's a rather famous writer group.
Sure.
And he takes like writers that are at his level, but
absolutely,
then also beginners.
Absolutely.
So how important do you think that is to kind of foster others now that you've got this book, it's out there? So how much of an obligation do you have to help other writers?
Oh, I love it. I mean, I think I feel really lucky to be teaching, because I'm lucky enough that I'm surrounded by students who at least have something of an interest, some more than others, but have an interest in writing and really want to learn how. And it's also nice because I'm teaching predominantly creative nonfiction essay classes. Mm-hmm. So I feel in a way that I get to, I joke with my students that I'm seducing them into a new genre, because I think their experience is much like mine. They're predominantly, they consider themselves fiction writers or poets. They don't know that creative nonfiction can be much more than kind of straightforward journalism, which certainly has its place, but I think the creative elements are what really pull students in. In his maximum security prison, where I have visited him for the first time, Kevin suggests that with our 8 remaining quarters, perhaps we should try the photo booth. This is something he wrote about in his letter, how a photo would mean so much. "I can't keep the film copy," he wrote, "but you could scan it and mail it to me, and I will tape it to my wall." The idea of the photo booth was, of course, alarming, the idea of sitting on his lap, the idea of that tiny curtain space. As a child, I had sat often in photo booths, inside movie theaters and skating rinks, my friends and I widening our eyes, pulling apart our cheeks to show tongues blue or green from pixie sticks. To sit across from Kevin at a table, sharing conversation and a board game, had seemed to me one thing. But to squeeze inside a photo booth, I was afraid, would force that uneasy reminder that while he is my friend, he is also a murderer, And it doesn't matter that he then phoned the police. It doesn't matter what three separate psychiatrists deemed it. It cannot matter the guilt he feels, the ownership he took, the sentence he is now serving, the apologetic speech he gave at his hearing, the apologetic letter he wrote to her family. "I wish I could take it back," he wrote. "I lost control somehow, but I wish to God it was my life I took." 3 years after the murder and 1,000 miles away, I can sit on my couch and forget what he did, if not my proximity to it. I can read his letter and I can forget what first happened. I can trust the authorities that somehow something did happen, that something in our body can short circuit and burst, a wire red and sparking in the drywall of our minds. I can get over the strangeness of what it is to be visitor number 3, just after his mother and father, and because he is allowed to list 10, there are 7 more names behind us, names Kevin put down just in case, because gaining clearance to be on his visitor's list can take months, so I should just do it now, he wrote me, just in case they ever come. And what I know that Kevin doesn't is that they will never visit. It's a shame he didn't get the chair, one said the day after Kevin's sentencing, for the things he did to that young woman. But for 4 years, Kevin was our friend. And what does friendship mean if when he needs us most, we are gone? So I can be here in this prison, but in this photo booth, there is no pretending. I am sitting on the lap of a murderer. It would be obvious even to me. Never mind his face, his skin, so young and white it might as well be paper. Never mind his smooth brown hair, cut to frame his skull like a mushroom cap, the same cut my brothers got, my father asking them to please sit still atop the backyard picnic table. Never mind that Kevin, like me, is 25, just 3 months younger, or that the towns where we were raised were just 17 miles from one another. Never mind his hands, which move the way an animatronic moves, controlled, abrupt motions, because it is very clear that he is nervous. In the photo booth in this prison, we would be so close that he could hurt me. And I want to think that it would never happen, but he hurt someone once, so who can say? We only get one photo, Kevin says. And when I finally bring myself to look at the machine, my mind turning over the words I'll use to carefully turn down his offer, I realize there is no booth and no curtain. There is no small, intimate space. That it is just a boxy piece of equipment. The background, even, is empty, a sterile white cinder block wall. Oh, I say, sure. And I stand beside him as he scrolls through photos that can serve as our digital backdrop. There's the Eiffel Tower or underwater. We can be on a roller coaster or in a rainforest or deep in space. We can even be on Everest. Finally, Kevin selects no background, and we see our image on the small glass screen. You're going to have to make me laugh, he says. He says it quietly, self-consciously, and I try to think of a joke quick but can't. The screen counts down until the flash, 3, 2, 1, and I think of a joke a boy told me once as we were driving home from a bowling alley. What kind of dog has no ears? I begin to say to Kevin, ready for the emphasized corn dog, but I only get to Has before the flash lights up and breaks. In the photo that prints at the front desk, my mouth will be open and my eyes shut.
What's your practice? What's your discipline writing? Do you force yourself to write every day, or did you have to wait till inspiration, or how does that work?
That's a great question. I would say ideally I'm forcing myself, but it's really difficult during the school year to be writing simply because I really feel strongly that my obligation is to my students. The summer months, the month of Christmas break, I throw up an auto message. I tell my students, you really won't hear from me unless it's an emergency. This is sort of my time. And during the school year, I give that to my students. But I have also sort of built a schedule that allows me in the mornings to spend a little time each day writing. And I find I'm always sort of taking notes. I use my phone all the time in terms of the notepad feature and also the voice memo feature. So often I find when I'm traveling is when the most inspiration strikes, and I'm always jotting down notes, always jotting down sentences or ideas to simply kind of speed the process along when I do have substantial time to sit and to write and to focus on craft.
So with visiting hours, what would you say that how much of this was perspiration versus inspiration?
This was sort of a struggle the whole way through. I mean, when I'm being honest, in a lot of ways, this was a book that I never intended to write, didn't want to write, still struggle with, frankly, in a lot of ways, ethically, morally. I think a first book is always hard. To be mining something that is so sensitive and also so proximate was really challenging and difficult. I began at the University of Iowa. I really didn't want to write about this at all. As I said, I kind of came with the intention of writing a book of comedic essays, largely about fear. I felt at that point in my life, just there was a lot of fears that I had, more common things, spiders, planes, but also larger things like violence. And so I began sort of writing that collection. It wasn't until my third year that I really realized that all of the energy that I was spending outside of the classroom was not at all about anything other than this one very particular fear. And so I began writing visiting hours, and I wrote about 100 pages in a year. As part of my thesis. And it was in that meeting that I had my readers, Robin Hemley, Bonnie Sunstein, and Megan Dom, tell me that, you know, this is interesting, but what separates this case is, why are you still writing this, man? Why do you care so much? Why do you find yourself sort of consumed by this desire to understand what happened? And so at that point, I really threw away those 100 pages. I don't think that they were a waste in any way, but I think it took 100 pages to really find what the heart of the book was about. And so then I wrote the book in another year and a half or so, in upstate New York and in New Hampshire, in these places that were in many ways sort of secluded. And so that's sort of how the book came about. But it's been a struggle and a process, for sure. I think the perspiration is very true. It was not only the physical work of sitting down and making myself engage with a subject matter that I didn't especially want to. It was dark, it was difficult, but also trying to, again, think about what is the story here and what is it that I'm really trying to say.
Well, and this is a large part of this is about fear.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
It's a different thing. So how much then do you rely on the muse process, in the sense that you started out with the idea you want to write about fear in a humorous way, and then all of a sudden the muse says, you're going to talk about Kevin.
I mean, that's certainly a challenge. And I think large parts of the book are completely about Kevin. And by the end, it sort of becomes, you know, I think to a certain extent, in the last year or so promoting this book, it's crazy to me how after a reading, I'll have, you know, 10 or so people come up to me and say that they found the book useful because it sort of mimicked their own experience. Either something like this has happened around them or to them, or they have this other thing that they sort of consider as, you know, Joanne Beard has this line in her essay, The Fourth State of Matter, that she pushes open the doors to the rest of her life. And it's about the shooting, the 1990 shooting of at the University of Iowa. And I think about that line a lot. I think all of us have this moment where, you know, figuratively, she's talking in a very physical way, that she pushes open the door, leaves this building where the shooter is at that same time entering. But I think about that. I mean, we all have, I think, that figurative moment of pushing open the door, of walking through part two of our life. And for me at this point, I mean, this felt largely like the event that I pushed it open and then everything changed. I mean, my mentor told me, he's like, this is essentially sort of a coming of age overnight. I mean, he literally walked you home, then this happened. And I mean, of course, in a lot of ways, that created a fracturing of sort of the world that I knew and the world that I sort of found myself trying very hard to understand. And so in a lot of ways, I think the muse is essentially sort of the governing force of, you know, again, I don't understand this. How can I understand this? How can I explore this with language?
Well, and part of the PTSD that you experience and that you write about, I mean, that's all about fear. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the fear of what could have happened.
Absolutely.
So it's that unknown part.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, mental illness more generally, when I think about why I was so interested in the subject matter, I mean, it's because depression, suicidal ideation, it is so very prevalent. It's something I was intimately familiar with. And yet it's sort of our last, or one of our last social taboos. I mean, it's overwhelming to me sort of how the sort of societal fear of saying, you know, I struggle with depression or I struggle with suicidal ideation. In a lot of ways, I think everything that I kept circling back to was, you know, in a lot of ways, my friend was dealing with this thing that he felt he couldn't share with others. And similarly, you know, I knew he was struggling with it. It was something I'd struggled with myself. And I still didn't feel as his friend that I could sort of say, I understand where you are. I've been there. And it's not even so much a it gets better that I think that I felt that I had failed him, but simply the idea of, you know, making him feel less alone, making him feel, you know, bolstered in that.
So in talking to that, there's a wonderful scene in the book when he he comes back after an extended away time from the college,
mm-hmm.
and you're staying at a reenactor's house.
Yes, the Civil War reenactor's themed house.
And so, and you talk quite honestly that I don't really know what to say. So it's actually a better thing for me not to say anything, and let's look at their underwear and their clothes and stuff, and
hoop skirts.
Go through that.
Sure, I mean, and I think that's very common, is this idea of, you know, someone that I care about is depressed. I don't feel equipped or trained to have that conversation. It's just generally sort of uncomfortable. So sure, you know, let me put on a movie. Let me take this person out to dinner. There's this idea that if we watch, you know, Gilmore Girls and eat ice cream, everything will get happy again, and that's simply not the case.
But it's interesting the way in which you handle it. It's not as much of an apology, but mm-hmm. you're going back and actually talking to the self before everything happened.
Absolutely.
How hard is that as a writer to go, you know the ending?
Absolutely.
I mean, actually, you start there's this isn't a cliffhanger in the sense you already know what's going to happen by the end of this book.
Absolutely.
So how do you as a writer then go back and say, okay, I've got to put myself in this place before,
mm-hmm.
and then talk to that?
I mean, I think when I think about essays, the best essays that I know of, they take a small moment and make it large. So they're finding some aspect, some scene, some moment that sort of symbolizes something much larger. And when I think about Kevin, when I think, you know, and all of this kind of came to light as I was writing, but when I think about sort of the responsibility I felt I had, when I think about the grief that I sort of struggle with, it largely hinges upon this fact that there were many opportunities to kind of make sure he was okay. You know, I didn't know the extent at which he was really struggling, but I think about this morning often. I mean, it was so eerie in a way. You know, it's the Civil War reenactor's theme house, which in itself is a little strange, certainly on a college campus. I mean, Gettysburg is this place that really sort of celebrates and thrives off of the remembrance of death, of 46,000 lives lost in 3 days. And it's, as a college student, it's really easy to separate yourself from that because it's annoying to have these, you know, ghost tours going through your campus. It's a little creepy and strange, and eventually you sort of make fun of it. But when I think about, you know, everything that was going on with Kevin, everything that would come, you know, I come back to this morning where it was just the two of us. It was the best way I knew how to sort of engage with him. And yet even in that moment that was very private, that was just the two of us, I could not say, you know, I know what you've been going through and I want you to know I've been there too. And I think those open dialogues are so important. It's not that I necessarily think I could have stopped it, but it's that I feel like I failed him as a friend, and I failed more largely just in general in having these open conversations and helping the person in the way that I feel I should have helped them.
So you started with 100 pages mm-hmm. in your thesis. You trashed those and then started again.
I did.
So as an essayist, and mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to kind of, I mean, this is a huge essay to talk about the book, but some of the other pieces, you've had pieces in the New York Times, some major publications. You can boil these down to an anecdote. Mm-hmm. Hey, I was good friends with a person who ended up killing somebody.
Absolutely.
How, at what part in this writing process do you realize, like, this is not an article anymore, this is a book, and then, like, this is going to be a, you know, 200 plus page book?
Sure.
How do you start out as a writer thinking that this is going to be that, or are you just in the process of this and saying, like, I can't get to the end of this without talking about my upbringing?
It's very much like that. I mean, but I will say, in a lot of ways, I had to trick myself. My initial thought was that I would write a collection of essays that were all sort of hearkening back to this. And in some ways, I think that would have been successful, but it would not have allowed for that sort of full narrative arc. So the way that I began writing this book after losing those 100 pages was I started thinking again in scene. I think I really like writing in scene. This book didn't necessarily lend itself to a narrative format because so much of it I thought was dependent on meditation. And sort of a cyclical, sort of obsessive meditation. And so that's sort of what I went about doing. But I kind of tricked myself in the sense that I wrote two essays, standalone essays, that I kind of used as sort of a testing ground. I published at least one of them. I think the other one I ended up not publishing. But I published one of them, and it was pretty successful in the sense that there were a lot of people who were responding to it and who were thinking, you know, about this and had similar experiences. And in writing those essays, I then realized, okay, well, I could crack I could crack the one open, the one preparing to visit Kevin in prison, which was, for me, so bound up in anxiety. It's not only that I'm going to see this person that I have very sort of complicated feeling towards, in the sense that he is both my friend, and I still don't understand what's happened. I still don't understand how, you know, there are two identities of this person that can walk me home one evening and sort of have that compassion, that empathy to walk me home. He's, you know, acting very normal. And then an hour later, you know, murders this young woman and says, I've had a psychotic breakdown. I mean, that to me was unfathomable. And so when I thought about the scene, when I thought about moments that mattered, it was preparing to see him, having all of these complicated feelings, going, arriving, you know, it's a whole process, and then having him come out and finding it's remarkably normal. I mean, we were talking as if no time had passed, as if this giant elephant was not indeed in the room. And so for me, when I thought about, you know, writing a book, I really had to trick myself into thinking in scene and in essays, and then cracking them open and kind of inserting, you know, meditation, research in between.
I could go on and on, but we're running out of time. And I just want to encourage everybody to get Visiting Hours. You can get in the conversation that we're talking about right now. It is a story that you have to read to the end, even though you already know what the end is at the beginning. So it's well worth your time. I highly suggest getting it either by buying it or checking out your local library. We have a little thing, our speed question round speed thing. I don't know. I'm going to ask you four questions.
Absolutely.
So pen or pencil?
Pencil.
Okay, so pencil or computer?
Computer.
And you're a big note taker, you said, on your phone.
I am.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What's on your reading desk right now? What are you reading right now?
That's a great question. Grace Notes by Brian Doyle.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you read multiple books at the same time?
At any given time, there's maybe 8 or 9. I think that's part of being a teacher, at least until summer, and then there'll just be one, hopefully.
And what would Amy now tell to the Amy younger self about being a writer?
Gosh, that you can do it. I mean, I really didn't imagine when I was young that I could make a career doing this. But it's always been my passion. I think there's so much importance in following the thing that you love most.
That's great. Well, thank you, Amy Butcher.
Absolutely, thank you.
And again, the book is Visiting Hours. I highly suggest you go out and get it. And thank you for watching.